Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment, the home edition. I'm Elvis Mitchell. The last time I was joined by my guest, Fran Lebowitz, she had yet to log in as many hours as she has with Martin Scorsese as she first appeared in the documentary Public Speaking. She's now in the new Netflix miniseries, docuseries, Pretend It's a City. It's always a pleasure to welcome Fran Lebowitz to the show. Fran, thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome.
There's so many things I was struck by in the show, but one of the things is as you were talking about the architecture of Grand Central, it just occurred to me that as an observer, as an audience, as so many things, you really seem to be attracted to things and people with a point of view.
Yes, of course. Who loves committees?
But it's funny because you shy away from saying that you're kind of open-facedly autobiographical, but I think there's so much of you that comes through work that watching that show, I find myself hungry again to read your writing. Are people saying that to you too now as they're watching the Netflix series?
Yes, people are saying that. And not that this is of general interest, but according to my publisher, or according, people started calling me and saying that they were trying to buy the Fran Lebowitz Reader and were unable to buy it. And so I had a conversation with my publisher. And it turns out that publishing, not just me, not just Fran's book, is having a terrible problem publishing books because so many printers are not working because they got COVID. And so printing plants, of which there are not a zillion, are understaffed, and it's such a skilled job that they're having trouble printing books. I know that's not what you ask, but I think that's interesting. So, I mean, it is interesting to me that, you know, this is a problem just at the time where more people might be reading more.
Yes, that's the most peculiar thing. You would think somehow that there would be people rush back into printing or to get as many books out as possible because people are reading more. Maybe that, unfortunately, as you mentioned, the problem is that people aren't reading books anymore.
Well, they're reading books, but they try to buy, for instance, my book, but they can't because they can't print enough because the printers are not working as much. I mean, another problem, and I bet you didn't know this. I only know this because a friend of mine published a book at the same time. When Obama's book was first published, many other books could not publish enough copies because Obama used all the paper. There was a paper shortage. And I said, that's ridiculous. I mean, the initial order or whatever, you know, the first print order on Obama's book was like a million. You know, they knew what was going to be like a million. The book is like 800 pages. Order the paper.
Oh, my God. I had no idea publishing had become a guns or butter situation. This is completely
yes,
new.
It's a problem. So, I mean, Obama used all the paper, and then the printers got sick. Not from Obama. In fact, from Trump. But if Obama, instead of writing a book, had been the president, we wouldn't have had the virus. But he was writing a book, something Donald Trump certainly cannot do since he's never read one. And so that's what happened. That's what's happening now.
But it's funny, though, in talking about this, because people I know, when I've talked to them about the show, they say, oh, my God, yes, I want to pick stuff up of hers again. I want to read her again. But there's so many things I find myself thinking about. Like, I know we discussed Mingus before, and I loved hearing you talk about him just because I could get a sense of what it was like for you just sitting in the room with him as you discussed him in the clip they showed with Spike Lee.
Well, I mean, the thing about, you know, Charles, I'm certain I said this in the show. I only knew him because the woman who owned the magazine I was working for, a little tiny magazine that was published out of her apartment, she was his girlfriend, which I didn't know. But I came into the office, which was also her apartment, one day, and I looked in the kitchen, and Mingus was sitting in the kitchen. First, I thought, that cannot be possible. And I thought, that guy, he looks so much like Charles Mingus. I mean, he really looks a lot like Charles Mingus. Like, he looks exactly like Charles Mingus because it was Charles Mingus. But you don't expect to walk into a kitchen and see Charles Mingus sitting at the kitchen table. as I came to know him, you would definitely expect to see him sitting at the kitchen table. But so that is how I met him, and that is how I knew him. And of course, you know, obviously before that, I loved his work. I mean, I think he's one of the most important artists of the 20th century, American artists. I loved his work. I just didn't expect to see him at the sitting at the kitchen table, and I didn't expect that I would know him. I never thought about it, really.
No, but when we discussed it before, you just that kind of incredulity, but then getting to know him, and yes, the kitchen table is exactly where he would be. I mean, I guess I just loved hearing you talk about him just because I love the way you talk about things that matter to you. There is such a precision in it. And I think that's what made me miss the writing so much, is hearing so much of this, these things. And I know people are kind of fixated on your being somewhat upset about some things, but your affection is what I find myself the most interested in. And you have affection for so much. And I think people don't talk about that so often.
Because not everyone's as smart as you are, Elvis. So people, what they see, they say, you know, Fran hates everything. Fran hates this about New York. She hates that about New York. She's complaining about this. She's complaining about that. And I've said to numerous people, you know, you only care this much, you know, about something you love. So my rage at things that are wrong in New York is because this is New York. Don't do this to New York. If you're going to do this horrible stuff, go do it somewhere else. You know, that's how I feel about things that I love. You know, and so it may come off as complaining, and it may in fact be complaining. But it's a different kind of complaining than the people who complain that I don't like complain.
My guest is Fran Lebowitz. Her new series on Netflix is Pretend It's a City, her newest collaboration with Martin Scorsese. But, I mean, does it infuriate you sometimes that people have boxed you up in this way? Because it really, it bothers me.
It doesn't really. I don't really think about it. I mean, I'm aware of it, you know, to some extent. I have less awareness of it than other people might have because I do not have a computer, so I'm not on the internet. So I don't see, you know, these things. People very often say to me, you're crazy. You should go on the internet. There's so many great things about you. I say, yeah, and I'm sure there's so many horrible things about me. So I don't want to see either one, frankly. Sometimes people can like you, I don't mean in a personal way, but like something you do and misunderstand you. Here's the thing. It is impossible to control other people's reactions. I don't even think about them. So, you know, you write something or you say something or you make something and some people are going to like it. Some people are not going to like it. And some people who like it are going to like it in the wrong way. And there's nothing you can do about it.
Well, I mean, it's funny you say like it in the wrong way, because one of the things that was fun, too, is listening to you. And I'm glad people get a chance to, through this show to see this, listening to you talk to Marty about movies, just because you have a great take on film. And as you remind or even inform people who may not have known it, you were writing about movies at one point.
Yes, but I wrote about movies not because I was such a person knowledgeable about movies. I wrote about movies because I had been writing about books for this little magazine that I mentioned that Charles Mingus's girlfriend owned. And there was another girl, who was writing about movies, and then she got an actual job writing an article for the New York Times, which, of course, no one could believe. She got this job, and while she was doing that, I wrote something about movies. And the second that was published in this minute magazine, people said to me, they talked to me about it. Oh, that was hilarious. I read this thing. And I realized more people are interested in movies than books. And it was fun to write about movies. So I asked, can I do this? And she said, no, because this girl's coming back from the New York Times. And I said, well, I just want to write about bad movies. Because I wasn't interested in being a critic, a film critic. I was interested in taking a ridiculous bad movie and writing something funny about it. And so she wouldn't let me do that. And so I went to interview and got a job doing that. I had a column called The Best of the Worst. It was only about bad movies. It was not meant to be bad reviews of good movies or bad reviews of movies that some people thought were good. Mostly these movies that I reviewed were made by a studio called AIP, American International Pictures. These movies mostly played in drive-ins. They played some of them in, the only places they played in New York were in Times Square, the old Times Square, not the present one. And I would go, I got myself on a list to go to these screenings, and it would be me and like 12 guys smoking cigars who own drive-in movies. That would be the only people in the screening rooms. Unbeknownst to me, one of the movies I reviewed that AIP made, Marty made. It was called Boxcar Bertha. And it wasn't until
David Carradine and Barbara Hershey, yes.
It wasn't until a few years ago that I even knew that Marty made it.
Really?
Boy, how did you know that? That is, you should be a movie reviewer. Did you ever think of that, Elvis?
Maybe in the next life. So,
I don't know this kind of stuff about movies. So, you know, Marty is a library of movies. A library. Marty has the most densely furnished mind with movies that surely could ever have existed, even though I know a few other people who are somewhat like Marty, but they're not Marty. Marty, once I was telling Marty something, a personal thing, and Marty goes, you know what that's like? That's like, you know, I'm making these numbers up because I don't remember. You know, in the second reel, in the third scene of that, you know, Buster Keaton movie where he's standing outside the candy store trying to decide what box of candy to buy his girlfriend? It's just like that, don't you think? And I said, no, I don't know the third scene of the second reel of the Buster Keaton movie. You're talking about a movie made in like 1903. He goes, you don't know it? I said, no. He said, I'm going to run it for you. And he did. And I guess what? The thing that I was telling him about was exactly like the third scene and the second reel. It was exactly like that. Not too many people like that.
Well, no. On the other hand, there aren't too many people like my guest, Fran Lebowitz. She's back after a 16-year absence from doing this show. If only because of her new project with Martin Scorsese. It's the series on Netflix, Pretend It's a City. We'll take a break. There's more of the comments to treatment. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. We're talking about the encyclopedic mind of Martin Scorsese with his collaborator, Fran Lebowitz, whose new project with Martin Scorsese is Pretend It's a City. And I guess I should start this part by asking you what you thought of public speaking after you finished with that, if you thought that you had another one of these in you.
I didn't think, I mean, Marty suggested it. I thought it was a bad idea. So we didn't do it. Because even though he's Marty and I'm not Marty, he still can't do it without me. So we didn't do it. And I'm not sorry that we didn't do it right away. I'm really not. I didn't want to do it for reasons that are right for me. So I don't want to do it. In the intervening 10 years, Marty made a couple movies, very good ones. So I doubt that he felt the lack. I doubt, you know, I mean, I never actually asked him this question, you know, but it would seem hard for me to believe that Marty would say, you know, why did I waste my time making Silence, which is one of my favorite of his movies, when I could have done another documentary on Fran? Why did I waste my time doing Wolf of Wall Street? I mean, he did plenty of other things.
And he let you work with him on Wolf of Wall Street, but you were saying it wasn't the right time. Why was it not the right time for you? What was keeping you from doing this again?
Because, you know, it just seemed to me like there shouldn't be two movies about the same person. It just didn't seem like, as my mother would say, nice.
Well, I guess I think about it this way, because you're not the same person. And more to the point, New York is not the same city. I mean, it's really as much about you reacting to New York as anything else. So if we're saying that maybe, in fact, you're the same person, then New York has changed in ways, large and small, that you're still reacting to. And this thing we were talking about in the first half, and it's almost, I don't know if it's Balzac who said it, but I think about this whenever I hear you talk about New York, that line that love is never so sweet than when it is new and strange. And just hearing you talk about what that New York was like, with all of its peculiarities and particular qualities, and how hard it was to get to know, but you just give into it, and eventually it becomes part of you. And that really lands here in this one.
Well, I mean, the thing is that, you know, at a certain point in your life, which I am not only at, but probably past, you have what used to be called the long view, you know, so that you can, you know, you understand certain things about New York, which seems maybe an impenetrable thing to people, but it feels very intimate to me. New York, to me, feels like a little village. It really does, but not with the bad aspects of a little village, you know, where everybody knows you, where everybody, like, you know, interferes with your life, but it has, it feels very homey to me, really homey, and I feel very intimate. I believe that in Manhattan, not in the rest of New York City, you could show me a still photograph of a corner without the street sign, and if it was a big enough view, I could tell you where that corner was, because I've walked every single inch of the city a billion times. New York has changed quite a bit. I would say New York has changed more than I have, you know, because I'm a person who basically has just pretty much never changed her mind. So it's really rare that I change my mind in any significant way. Someone asked me recently, what makes a real New Yorker? And I would say a real New Yorker is anyone who lives in New York, whether they lived here for 2 weeks or 2 years or 50 years, but the first time that person says, they closed my such and such, or what happened to the, and that could happen in 2 weeks, you know? So that's how fast, you know, someone becomes a New Yorker. That's how fast someone gets angry. I think I might have told this in Pretenders City, which I don't remember because it was a long time ago we met it. I remember very vividly the first time this happened to me. And I was on the 8th Avenue bus going uptown, something I did not do frequently. I did not take the bus frequently. And there used to be on the south, when I say used to be, I mean in like 1970, like on the southeast corner of 42nd and 8th, there had been a bank. And I look out the bus window, and the bank was gone. It was demolished. And I was incredibly upset. Where's the bank? Not that I'd ever been in this bank. And by the way, then, not that I was ever in any bank. And not that I cared about a bank, and I still don't. But that bank was supposed to be there, because it was there when I got here. This was across the street from the Port Authority. So that bank was supposed to be there, because that's New York is supposed to stay in people's minds the way it was when you got here. And as soon as it changes from that, people start complaining. I mean, we shot in Grand Central Station for Pretenders of City. Before the virus, when I was in Marty's office and in his screening room, there was a kid, he was an intern for one of the editors, I think, and he was complaining. This is like a 21-year-old kid, complaining, Fran, do you know the, I don't know what they're called, but they're the boards where they show the trains, the ones that are, you know, the schedule for the trains. Mm-hmm. They changed them. They used to be, and I mean forever, I don't know what you call it, but like these kind of like blinds almost that, you know, clack, open and closed, and they turn them into electronic boards.
They flip
boards.
Over with the numbers. Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely, yes.
So it's like a year ago, they changed them, and they're now electronic. So this kid was hysterical. He was so upset. Look, they changed it. Isn't this horrible? I said, how do you even know that? He said, I live in Westchester. I come every morning to Grand Central Station. He was very upset. Why? Because his Grand Central Station that he has seen his whole life was now different. That's in New York.
It is. And I think that's that particular affinity that you and Marty have about New York comes out, for example, when you're talking with him about his New York set movies and you're talking about what the cab ride was like for you and that you'd been in that same cab that Griffin Dunn had been in and had that same kind of experience. And that ownership of a moment in time in New York. Again, this thing I was talking to you about in the first half. That's what I point to, and I tell people to watch this show, because in moments like that, that's when we get to see who you really are. I mean, there's an just like a moment ago, there's an excitement in your voice, and we can feel that affection, and it makes you seem incomplete to describe you as somebody who's just complaining about something, because that's not who you are. But hearing again that just being back in that moment again, describing what's like being in a cab, like in that scene, that was a terrific moment to watch.
I don't know what year that movie was, Griffin's in the Cab, but I'm sure Marty does, but he's not here. But I don't know what year that was. But that's when cab drivers changed in New York. You know, the kind of person who drove a cab, the way they drove the cab. So it seemed to people in New York like there used to be all the cab drivers were the same, which is they were, you know, complaining maybe. I mean, when I first got to New York, all the cab drivers were complaining about Lindsay all the time. No matter what happened, it was Lindsay's fault. They all smoked cigars. They wore these caps. They were mostly these kind of working class Jews. Then at a certain point, different cab drivers came. And the thing that distinguished them was they drove like maniacs. I mean, maniacs. So that you were used to getting into a cab that drove normally. I mean, normally for New York. And all of a sudden, you get in a cab and you would be begging, pleading with the cab driver to slow down. But no one had ever noted that in any sort of work of art, you know, or even in any sort of, you know, passing, you know, newspaper article. It's just something New Yorkers were living through. They were complaining to each other about it. And then all of a sudden it was in Marty's movie. And when I saw that, I remember going to the theater to see that movie when it first opened. And the reason I laughed so hard was because it never occurred to me someone was going to put that in a movie. They were going to show you this is what's happening. And it was hilarious. And Marty told me that that really happened to him. You know, the same thing with the $20 bill blowing out. But that particular kind of cab ride was happening to everybody. And we didn't know what caused it. You know, and we still don't, now that I think about it. I mean, Marty never explained, you know, where did these crazy cab drivers come from? Why did they all start driving cabs at once? Why did they all drive the cab in the same way? I mean, it was maniacal. They might have come from someplace where you made more money if you drove more crazily. I don't know, but it was incredibly, it doesn't exist now. That phase didn't last that long.
It's a dream. We're talking about Martin Scorsese's 1985 movie, After Hours, with my guest, Fran Lebowitz. See, I can do this stuff too. But I guess I was really struck too in the film because you're talking about taxis, and you also end up talking about, in effect, taxi driver, in that great sequence when De Niro is at that 24-hour cafeteria, and you knew that place.
Yes, because that was a place where cab drivers ate. First of all, you know, now when you talk to someone young, you have to practically tell them what a cafeteria was. So it's very labor-intensive having a conversation with someone who's young, I've noticed. You have to say, each thing. You know, like I was having dinner with someone a few years ago, this young girl, and I said something about Richard Burton, and I got this blank look. And I said, you know who Richard Burton was? And she said, he was an actor, right? Right. So cafeterias, they used to have them in New York. In fact, they used to have them all over the country. Not just in your school, but as an actual commercial enterprise. So this was a cafeteria. It was on Park Avenue in the 20s. It was called the Belmore Cafeteria. It was open all night, as were many restaurants then, by the way, open all night. But the lure to the cab driver was not only that it was a cafeteria, meaning the food was not expensive, but also whoever owned that place or managed it had some kind of deal with the cops because you could leave the cab in front of there. Which one of the problems of driving a cab is you could never leave the cab because it would get towed away or you'd get a ticket, which would like wipe out your whole day's or night's work, but you could leave the cab there. And so I was telling Marty that I used to go in there when I drove a cab and no one would talk to me. I mean, literally no one would talk to me because I was a girl and I was a girl at the time. I was a young girl. And all the cab drivers were like these, you know, Jewish guys with the caps and the cigars. And I think that the reason they were so rude to me, I don't know how to put it, was because I think that they were scared. Like they were thinking, is this what's going to happen? These kids, these girls with long hair. There were already a few hippie cab drivers, you know, like guys with long hair. This was way beyond their, you know, ability to perceive something. So I remember New York Magazine wrote an article like, is this the best restaurant in New York? Because all these cab drivers eat here. And I remember thinking at the time, what would make you believe that the greatest judges of food would be cab drivers? You know, it's like that when I was young, they used to say, this is a great diner. The truck drivers eat here. Like, these are the great connoisseurs of food. Usually places that people who drive places eat in, they eat there because you can park. Not a great recommendation for a restaurant, necessarily.
I guess, too, I was struck by something else because I think of you in so many ways. First of all, you're beautifully turned out ensemble. One of the things I didn't know about you was what you talk about and pretend it's a city is walking around New York barefoot. Now, you have incredible shoes, incredibly well-made shoes, so that you walked around New York City barefoot. I thought I actually dreamed it and I wasn't actually hearing it.
You know, of course, many people have asked me about this. And some people ask me, why did I do this? And I have to tell you something that, you know, I was really young when I did this. You know, I did this like maybe the first year I was in New York in the summer. And I don't know why I did this, you know, because it was idiotic. You know, it was incredibly stupid to do that. And, you know, dangerous to some extent, obviously, because New York was filthy at the time. Not that it's pristine at the moment, but I mean, filthy. No sane person would walk around without shoes, but I did. I did. I don't know why I did it. I guess I thought it was great. Look, this is a good look. Let me walk around without shoes. And I did it for a while. And by the way, I didn't start a trend. There weren't that many people that crazy, you know, that I knew. So, because someone asked me, did all your friends do it? No. I don't remember anyone emulating this, I have to tell you. So I did it for a while. I don't know why I did it. I mean, I used to walk around, you know, when I was young and I lived with my parents, I walked around the house barefoot and sometimes into the yard barefoot. I never, by the way, once I got my first apartment in New York, which was after the barefoot walking, during the barefoot walking, I was staying in other people's apartments. I never walked around my apartment barefoot because the high density of insect population in that apartment. So I don't know why I did it. I cannot defend it. It was totally idiotic.
I've always thought you as being somebody who has an eye for shoes, because for me, you, shoes are selected for both comfort and drama, and your shoes do both, don't they?
I really have very few pairs of shoes. I mean, I have the shoes I'm wearing now, which are cowboy boots, which I had made, I would say, I think these were made 2008. The guy who made them was so crazy that, and it took so long that when I finally got them, I thought, take care of these, Frank, because I can't go through that again. So I think of these in a certain way as the last boots. Don't, you know, I've always been very careful to always have my shoes shined once a week, et cetera. But as you can imagine, you can't, I mean, I suppose you could, but you're not likely to get very good cowboy boots made in New York City. So you have to find someone who's either in Texas or New Mexico or Arizona. And naturally, these type of crafts, you know, there are not that many people who do them anymore or are good at them. So I'm very careful of these shoes. But I'm not a shoe lunatic.
No, no, that's not what I'm implying even. Just that you choose shoes that as soon as I see them, I go, well, those are the kinds of shoes, obviously, it's a dumb thing to say out loud. But I think you choose shoes that you have an eye for them, I think. And it's not like you, again, I've never seen you wearing a whole lot of different pairs of shoes, but I've just always been fascinated by that. So again, to hear that you were not wearing shoes at one point, I thought, well, okay, I guess in a weird way, this kind of completes the loop, doesn't it?
Yes, but I will not be going back to the barefoot look.
I wouldn't let you. It's always such a pleasure and a treat to talk to you. Thank you again so much for doing this, friend.
Oh, thank you.
And I look forward to seeing you again soon. I'm wearing a pair of George Cleverleys now, by the way. My guest, of course, is in New York. It's Fran Lebowitz. Her newest venture with Martin Scorsese is Pretend It's a City. Our recording engineer at KCRW, who also mixes the show, is Kat Yor, is edited by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everybody. Let's go get some new shoes. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.